accession number 6365, reel 1.
Colonel Glover, reel 1. Which year were you born, Colonel Glover?
1912, Irene, North London.
And what did your father do for
a living? My father was an MO, a doctor, and in the First World War, he was an MO to 49th Division, the First Battle of Ypres. Then he came back and dealt with cerebral spinal fever, which he was became an expert in. But having known him, we went for one very short holiday to France, and we toured the battlefield of the Somme, which was of great interest to me later on.
Was there much military in your family background?
Military?
Military.
No, none. Almost none. Father, grandfather were both doctors, and the elder one was a ship owner from South Shields.
Where were you educated?
I was educated at a prep school called Tittenhanger Lodge, and then at Arundel. Actually, I was going from Tittenhanger to the Navy. I'd always been keen to join the Navy, but just before I went up for the naval exam, which was at the age of 13 in those days, the Washington Treaty was signed, and my father said, "You'll be out of a job at 30, I wouldn't do it." So he changed me around. A friend of mine who was about level with me at school went on, and of course hit it exactly right and became an admiral.
When were you commissioned?
Either the end of 37 or beginning of 38, I can't remember. I'd tried when I was in London to join the Marines, but they were terribly stuffy. Unless your father and grandfather had been Marines, they didn't want to know you. So when I got down, I had a job which caused me to move to the Ipswich area, and I'm sure that war was coming. I'd been married in 36, and I was sure, well, the Abyssinia had got started then, I was sure war was on the way, so I thought, well, I better get into the local TA, and I did. That was 58th Medium Regiment.
What kind of duties did you have in the TA?
Well, originally, I suppose I had a fairly good background. I'd travelled quite a bit. I'd been more than the average youngish man, I suppose. I'd been to America when I was at Cambridge on a job. I'd travelled in France, Germany, Italy. And I was given the job of a new job, which had just been really done, or was done with a short out, of ACPO, which is Assistant Command Post Officer. That was when I suppose I was a section leader in the actual war, when I was brought in, one of the two subalterns under the GPO.
What exactly were the duties of an ACPO?
Working out fire plans, doing the survey of a troop when you got into action. You'd get the survey officer, would give you a place, and you'd mark it up, work out the thing, and really work out fire plans and predicted fire and things like that. There was rather an elaborate new French system that had been brought in the end of 38, I came in. It was better than the old system. The old system was absolutely ghastly. I mean, it took you all night to produce a predicted thing. The new system, anyway, quickened that thing up, and eventually, of course, later on, we became very good at these quick actions. And did most of our fire, but this was later on when I was an IG. But the thing was shortening time. That was what the whole operation was.
So the thing was an imitation of French army methods?
That's where we got it from at that time, I know. But it was pretty cumbersome, even so.
What was the reputation of the French artillery in those days?
Oh, good. I don't think they deserved it, but it was good.
Why don't you think they deserved it?
Well, they made an awful ball of it on later. And I've never believed, they were more or less unmechanized. Later in the talk, we'll come to a place where I met two regiments of artillery. They were just walking slowly along about powering their horses. We at least had even if our old 6-inch guns, we at least could tow them at 8 miles an hour. Allowed to go at 8 miles an hour, we were on wooden wheels.
What was the reputation of the actual artillery pieces that the French possessed?
I really wouldn't have known. The old 75 they still had in masses of them. And I really saw nothing else. I really hardly came across the French at all.
Coming now to the declaration of war by Chamberlain at the beginning of September 39, did that take you by surprise?
Not a bit. No. It was quite clear to everybody, I think. We went to camp. It wasn't that we used to have a firing camp every 2 years. The previous year we'd been down to Okehampton, and this was a non-firing camp, and we went to Rodine and exercised on the South Downs. While we were there, Ribbentrop made his pact with Russia, and war obviously was, you know. We did go back home, and just about got back in the business, so to speak, when we were called up a few days later.
What did the attitude of people seem to be towards the declaration of war?
Jolly good. I mean, anything you could do, that was, I could put it that way. You know, we all thought that was bound to happen. I was very glad I was in a unit. Because I was in a job which, if I'd wanted to go, I suppose I could have been reserved occupation. A lot of people who were, in fact, all my colleagues were all immediately reserved. We were busy on a lot of defence contracts, making plastics, especially the transparent cellulose acetate sheeting for bomber panels and things like that. And I was just delighted. I mean, I'd have been very annoyed if I'd got myself reserved. But I hadn't. I'd been in the tier, and that was that.
Did there seem to be any open enthusiasm for the declaration of war?
I wouldn't say it's enthusiasm. I mean, everybody thought it was going to repeat of 1914. And I remember my father, when he saw me off, last time he saw me in, I suppose it was just before we left for France in January of 40, he said, "Well, goodbye, Obi. You know what this means. OP officers, brave officer Littleworth, average life 14 days. Cheerio." You know, that was the kind of feeling you had about it. You weren't going to survive very long, you didn't think. But again, you hoped that the thing wouldn't possibly work. I don't think there's any thought that the Obi Christmas, any nonsense like that. I think everyone was far more realistic about what we were up against than they were in 1418.
Do you think that there was a realistic estimate of the strength of the German army in September 1939?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I don't think our people were Maginot flavoured, but the French were. And it was a lot of cobswallop. The thing only went halfway round, and after it, they'd done it all before coming through Belgium. You know, I suppose that's hindsight, but you know, one can never. I really couldn't think that it would. But of course, we weren't allowed in anywhere near Belgium. It was absolutely, the Belgian authorities had a rigid line. Anyone who strayed across the frontier was arrested. And they wouldn't have any talks with us. This is, I didn't know, and I was far too junior to know, but I really, you know, it's difficult sometimes to know what you read afterwards or what you read before or what you knew before.
Do you recollect anybody being opposed, to your personal knowledge, being opposed to the declaration of war on Germany?
No, none. Mark you, I was in a kind of, I suppose most of my friends were, they were either going into war or about to go into war, and they were all volunteering. But I had a lot of chaps. Awful lot of our particular regiment were from about two firms, and one of them was a local brewery, Green King, and one of my fellow subalterns was the managing director. And I think they, out of our 300 and so odd people in the battery, I think 150 were from this one brewery. And the jolly good chaps they were too. Splendid. Good Suffolk country boys.
Which particular unit were you in?
Well, I suppose originally, one, you see, the general someone really didn't care at this moment. I think the 4th East Anglian Division was our actual, so to speak, parent unit when we were embodied. But we quickly moved out of that. And what we moved into, I honestly don't remember. We were inspected by a chap called General York. I think it was just before we, or either just before we left for Borden or just after we got to Borden. And he was a chap we'd seen before. He was East Anglian Division Commander, or Eastern Command, whatever he was. And after about 3 or 4 weeks sitting around Sudbury, we were embodied in Sudbury. We had a troop in Sudbury, a Sudbury troop, which I was attached to at that time. And the rest of the battery was up at Bury St Edmunds. And the other battery in RHQ was at, we're in Ipswich. We were up to strength and formed a second line, of course, 67th Medium, which had gone, which went off later on.
Which medium did you say?
I think it was 67. We were 58.
Can you tell me what the medium regiments of the RA consisted of in those days?
4 troops of 4 6-inch BL howitzers. 1918 variety. And we hadn't been converted in any way at all. They were just as they came off the battlefield in France. I think some of them had fired quite a lot of rounds. Some were, so to speak, new and never been fired. Maximum range, what? 11,000 yards, something of that order. Iron tires. Pulled all our earlier time by elderly lorries. But one of the earlier things we got were these magnificent Scammels, which were far too good, really, for us. And most expensive vehicles, and they didn't tell us how to drain them properly. So we lost 12 of them the first night. It froze really hard. Cracked our cylinder blocks. We had an instruction. There were 2 drain cocks. There was one obvious one, which everyone poured out. There was another smaller one around the side somewhere, which no one knew any about. And we lost 12 out of a 16, I think, or lost 8 or something, some appalling number. And a really bad frost we had very suddenly after we got given to the start. It was ghastly, wasn't it?
Why do you say the Scammels were too good for you, though?
Well, they were the most beautiful, brilliant, expensive vehicle. And they could pull, well, almost anything they did. They pulled transporters with a 70-ton tank on it. Terrifically powerful, very high. And to put them, I suppose if we were going to be rearmed immediately with a decent gun, a modern gun, a 4.5 or something like that, that would be fine. But as we were limited with these steel tires to 8 miles an hour on a road, it really seemed like giving a Rolls Royce to carry a dustman's cart. They were marvellous vehicles, just marvellous. And of course they lost the whole war. They gave them. We got AECs later in the war when I was again still in the medium regiment. And the Scammels were far. They didn't have much room in them, but by God, they would pull anything. First thing we pulled down was a tree, which we got muddled up with down our all shot, and it fell across the main telephone wires, very unfortunately. And we pulled the tree away somewhere else and left it there. And the post office must be really amazed how his tree fell down. But they'd pull anything. You could pull a house down just as easy as that.
What would be the role of a medium regiment of artillery as compared with the heavy and super heavy?
Well, I suppose it'd be an awful waste of time firing a medium gun at that kind of gun, 100-pound shell, went off a good old bang. It was a nasty thing to hit. I suppose, really, you wanted to use it on buildings and things like that. It really a rather a waste of time. I think, on troops. Anything, you know, protected, good thing. Made a big hole. It had a time fuse in it, or not an instantaneous fuse. Knock a building down, splendidly, you know, or trench, dugout, that kind of stuff. And I don't think we ever fired, and we ever trained to fire any airburst, which was, of course, we did later on in the war.
Later on after the BEF, you mean?
Yes. Yes, we fired a lot of airburst shells in the, when we got the proximity fuse, when we took part in the Battle of Reichswald in 44. But that was a different regiment and a different time.
Where, as far as your TA training was concerned, did you and your brother officers feel that your training had been sufficient for the task that the BF had to perform?
Well, we were terribly, terribly green. We really were. We had a jolly good adjutant who scurried us along and helped a lot. He was a regular, a chap called Larry Toomey. He's dead, but it wasn't really. Well, see, what had one done? I'd been 1, 2, 3, 5, 6 weeks possibly at camp before I was called up. One's ideas were pretty rudimentary. On about an exercise once every fortnight or something at home when during the summer, drill nights, or every week in the winter. Probably sometimes 2 a week towards the end. Which, you know, was only purely theory. And, when we went to Borden, we did a lot of exercising and training at Borden, and got a lot better. But I think still, when we got out to France, we were pretty rudimentary. Terribly keen, but rudimentary. No.
Did you have any regulars attached to your unit once you got to France?
I think we had an AIG, it's a WO instructor. I think we had, or he came from time to time, I think. He may have come for a fortnight, third time. I don't think we had any commissioned IG. I don't remember him.
Did you come across the system, as far as you personally were concerned, of TA people exchanging places with regulars in different units?
Well, most of the TA regiments I knew of just didn't change at all, almost throughout the war. And this one didn't. I mean, I was sent on a troop commander's course we seemed to have weren't getting our equipment in at the time with me, and there was a lot of war going on. And I got terribly fed up, and I was sent on a troop commander's course, and I'd just been promoted acting captain and a troop commander. And I got an A. And at the end of the course, the Major IG, who was in charge of it, said, would I like to come to Larkhill and instruct? And I jumped at it. And I said myself, I was supposed to be in a very good IG, and I couldn't. One of the troubles then, once you became a good IG, damn difficult to get out of being an IG, you know. They clung on to you. I had a hell of a time getting away.
Can we go on next to the actual move to France and when that came about?
Yes. I'll refer to this little book, which I've got here. It gives us all the dates, and I'll get them right in time. We had moved down to a place called Kingsley on the 10th of December, 39. And on the 31st December, an advance party left for France. On the 10th of January, the vehicles left and embarked at Southampton. And on the 16th of January, the regiment embarked and sailed for Cherbourg.
Did the move go smoothly, or were there any problems?
Well, the only real problem was it was the worst and coldest winter ever. and we had Donars getting actual frostbite, and the trucks freezing up the whole time, and it was almost impossible to, you know, you'd empty radiators. We had the antifreeze freezing, which was terribly difficult. You know, it made the start up, and we were getting up about 5 o'clock in the morning, and we were moving. It was terribly difficult to keep the bloody things running. You had to start them up and pour dribble coal or hot water into them. It was absolute murder. And I was made, because I spoke a bit of French, I was made billeting officer. So I used to, and when we got to France, so I used to run round and pay all the Frenchmen billeting money, and then chase after the, I had an 800-weight truck, and chase after the regiment, catch them up as soon as I could. But I mean, every day that week, or that few days we were moving up to thing, I had my pack behind my seat. My sponge was absolutely like a brick, frozen, absolutely solid, just straight behind my back. It really was incredibly cold. And these wretched chaps trying to ride motor bicycles. They didn't have, the equipment they had later on, a proper Donar suit, you know, weatherproof. They just absolutely murdered us.
You say they actually got frostbite?
Yeah. One of our Donars, I remember seeing you. Now, I'd never seen frostbite before, but yeah, they were quite white.
Was the move to France made in secrecy or openly?
Oh, yes. I mean, there were all kinds of things. We went along to see where we were going or when we were going or something like that. Of course, all our wives knew. And I remember our final dinner, which was a place called the Anchor at Liphook. It's a well-known pub. My wife, we had a brigadier and somebody sitting at another table. We were about 16 of us, I think, 8 of us and our wives, having a final kind of dinner. And I remember my wife saying, oh, well, don't be seasick tomorrow or something like that. And I said, oh, for God's sake, don't say things like that. Yes, it was as secret as they could make it, I suppose. And, of course, we didn't know where we were going to. Southampton might have been Havre anywhere, but it was Cherbourg, in fact. And we arrived off there in the dim light of the morning, having been escorted across. We were in a cross-channel ferry. I can't remember her name. She was one of the well-known ones, which had normally done, I think, the Southampton-Dinard run. And we had, I think, the whole regiment on board, all on one ship. I had taken some seasick pills. I thought I'd better. And that was fine until we got inside the, I don't know if we were in Cherbourg, but it has a huge breakwater, Napoleonic kind of thing across the front, and had a big bay inside. We were going to go into that, but then they were full apparently, so we had to sit outside in a frightful slop. And I'd just eaten a rather good breakfast of bacon and eggs. I felt awfully ill for a bit, but then we moved inside and all was well. And I can remember very little about the drive up, except I say I was billeting officer. I was made that because I spoke French to a certain degree, and it was rather nicer having a job like that because one moved by oneself and didn't have to keep in a convoy or anything like that. And you just finished, you know, went around all the places, you had a list of them, paid them their billeting money, received any complaints or checked up on anybody you knew who'd made a mess of anything. We were rather careful in those days. We followed a terrible regiment, who should be nameless, who were from Glasgow, and they'd been in an awful mess. And we were, unfortunately, followed them along and got a bad name from, and we found an awful lot of muck in certain places. We used to clean up our rooms, and I used to inspect them and see that they were all clean. And mind you, chaps, we were lucky if we didn't get undercover much. The chaps were all in barns every night, and it was freezing cold. God, it was cold. Some of the officers got into 3 or 4 into a room. But, you know, that was it from a billeting point of view. Well, it wasn't in houses as we'd been in. So we all thought, you know, this is war.
How had the French received you at Cherbourg? With indifference or with any sign of greeting or what?
I'd have said it was pretty indifferent. They'd kind of seen it all before, in a way. And I don't think they never struck me as being at all anxious for the war in any way.
Did you ever come across any hostility on the part of French civilians towards the British Army?
No, I can't say I did, ever. And when we got to our own little, you know, when we were billeted in this village called Vermel, which is a pure straight mining village, no sanitation whatever, we had these ghastly holes in the floor, you know. They were perfectly straightforward, was perfectly pleasant.
Had you taken all your equipment with you to France, or was any left behind at first?
I think we left some of the regimental silver and stuff behind. But my father, who was a great collector of cannon, he had given each RHQ and the two batteries, each a rather nice brass gun, which we fired on several occasions when we were having a party. And they were all lost in Dunkirk. That all went. But the ordinary regimental silver had gone, had been left behind. Such as it was, something was wrong, eh?
Where did you move up to from Cherbourg exactly?
Well, we went by train when we first arrived to La Huta. And I'm not quite sure. I may be able to check out where this is because my map is. I hoped I'd have some better maps than I've got. And we arrived at 6 a.m. and we marched to some billets in Fresnes-sur-Sarthe. And then we met up with our vehicles, which had come from earlier. So after that, we went in our own vehicles from Fresnes to Evreux. And from Evreux to Breteuil. And on the 22nd of January, we went from Breteuil to Vermel.
Was that the place where you were billeted?
Yes. We were there some time. This was the Second Corps area, and we came under the CCRA Second Corps.
What does CCRA stand for?
Corps Commander Royal Artillery.
Can you tell me about your work as a billeting officer, how you went about it?
I've never done it before. I simply had a list of billets. I knew how many chaps they had in there. They got so much for straw, so much for this, so much for that. And it was, you know, it was very small money. And for the officers, you had a list of the things. You went round. You used to pick up anything you could find that had been left behind, if you could, if it was, you know, movable. And just paid them and got out as far as you can. The regiment probably left at 6 o'clock in the morning. You'd probably get off by about 10 and drive hell-foot to catch them up.
Did the French civilians seem to be happy to billet the British troops?
I don't remember any problems. Except, as I say, the regiment had been before us, had made a particular mess in one farm, and they were very angry. And I said, I'm terribly sorry, but it's not us. It was 2 nights ago. It wasn't us. And he admitted it. But he wasn't very pleased, as you might expect. But nothing serious.
How long were you at Vermel? Approximately?
We stayed there till we went the end of February, when we moved down to the Somme area and came under the GHQ artillery troop. It was really a training area, but the roads were so frosted and so bad, and we were heavy stuff, that we weren't allowed to move for the first 3 weeks at all. And I luckily had brought a copy of my father's official history of World War I with me. Kind of good anticipation, I thought. And we had to keep ourselves busy routine watching and trying to get fit and running and do this and the other. We weren't allowed to drive a vehicle other than essential traffic fetching rations. Because the roads were in a hell of a state. You see, they were all pavé. They were absolutely frozen. Thing, and if you went along with a heavy truck, you'd break them to pieces. As did happen, of course. A bit of it.